Many of the most popular action movie franchises of recent years, the X-Men trilogy, the Fantastic Four films, even the recent hugely popular Iron Man, originated as comic books either co-created or sometimes drawn by artist Jack Kirby. His influence on pop culture began when he co-created the character of Captain America in 1940, and it hasn't stopped since. Right after Iron Man became a mega hit on its opening weekend, Marvel Studios announced that future projects on its schedule included movie versions of Captain America and Thor, and a new big-screen version of The Incredible Hulk is right around the corner. All of those characters wouldn't exist if not for Jack the King Kirby. His partnership with Stan Lee at Marvel Comics in the 1960s was wildly influential and changed the direction of comics. Mark Evanier met and worked for Jack Kirby at a young age and has just written a combination biography and art book. It's called Kirby, King of Comics. And it's the second book Evanier has written about an influential but often overlooked art form lapped up by young readers. The first was a book on Mad Magazine. Mark Evanier has written for comics, but also has written for TV. He was a story editor on Welcome Back, Kotter, and worked on one of the most infamous TV failures of all time, Pink Lady and Jeff. But when I spoke with Evanier, we were both most eager to talk about Jack Kirby. Mark Evanier, welcome to Fresh Air.
Thank you.
Jack Kirby, who created or co-created such comic book icons as Captain America, Fantastic Four, and the X-Men, is he credited correctly or given too much credit for changing illustrations from sort of comic strip to a much more dynamic, all over the page, all over the spread kind of thing? Was that really Jack Kirby?
I think that the two people who, well, three actually, counting Jack's partner, Joe Simon, and also the other one would be Will Eisner, were the men who invented comic books as being different from comic strips. Before Kirby and before Eisner, a comic book was a repasted newspaper strip page, and it had all the limitations of those little 3-4 panel syndicated strips, panels of all the same height, everything tucked in neatly, distance shots, not a lot of different camera angles. Unnecessarily, Jack was one of the first people to say, we're doing comic books here. And he had his character start spilling out of the pages. He designed pages as a whole, as opposed to just designing individual panels. And he did full page panels. He did double page spreads. Jack liked big pictures. And when he did do newspaper strips, he found them confining and small. And when he had that big canvas to paint on with comic books, he just cut loose.
Jack Kirby was born Jacob Kurtzberg.
And yes.
So many of the key figures in the golden age of comics, I mean, not only Kirby, but Jerry Siegel and Joe Shuster, who created Superman, and Bob Kane, who created Batman, and Stan Lee of Marvel Comics, and M.C. Gaines of Mad, they're all Jewish. Why so many and why so influential?
Well, I think that part of it was that comic books were an easy entrance business in the late 30s, early 40s. It was one of the few fields where a kid could sit down at the kitchen table, whip up something, go in and get a glamour job. There were ads in the New York Times and other places for people who'd want to do comics. And in the early days, there was no one who was so lousy that the industry couldn't find some place for them. So that was part of it. Also, there was a certain sense of camaraderie. An awful lot of the guys who got into comics earlier not only were Jewish, but they all came from the same high school.
Really?
You know, Will Eisner, who did The Spirit, and Bob Kane, who did Batman, were in the same high school together. They were in DeWitt Clinton High. And a lot of this was people getting their buddies in. So, I got into comics. I'll follow you into the field. You know, right now, if you got all your friends into your line of work, you'd be bringing in a lot of people who probably matched your ethnicity or at least your income or your neighborhood. So I think there was a certain amount of that too. There was also an awful lot of Italian kids, same reason, who got into comics in the early days. They knew each other. They helped each other out. But also it was a field you could get into with very easy access because it wasn't on the radar of real illustrators or real writers at the time.
Was there any anti-Semitism in terms of them not being able to get other jobs in ad agencies at the time? Or
I don't know of any of that. A lot of these guys did not have education. There was a prejudice in ad agencies, I think, against someone who didn't have, 2 years of Pratt Institute on their resume. And an awful lot of the guys who got into comics in the early days were self-taught. So I think that that was a difference. If you were poor enough, if you were too poor to go to Pratt Institute and become, you know, the next Norman Rockwell, you could ad lib something and become the next Chester Gould in comic books.
Early in Jack's career, he drew under various pseudonyms and signed his art with different names. Why did he do that, and where did he get the names?
Jack started off, one of his earliest jobs in comics was in a very low-rent newspaper syndicate called Lincoln Features, which was kind of the 99-cent-only store of newspaper syndicates. And they did quite a few different strips, and so they wouldn't all have the same name on. They put different names on every strip. And it was very common at the time for Jewish kids to try to sound less Jewish in their signatures. You know, Al Kaplan became Al Cap in the Little Abner strip, not so much because they were trying to hide their heritage, but because you wanted to sound like a professional. You wanted to – one of those – you know, just like actors change their names to something that sounds like an actor. Jacob Kurtzberg did not sound like an artist. Jack Kirby did. And Jack just put all these different names. I think some of them – I don't think he even came up with some of them. Kurtzberg, I assume somebody just kind of tried Kirby because it was shortened from Kurtzberg.
And was Stan Lee's name Stan Lee?
Stan's name at birth was Stanley Lieber. And Stan at that point, like a lot of guys who got into comics in the early days, thought, well, I'll just do this for a few years and then I'll go off and I'll become, you know, more successful. Stan was going to write the great American novel. And so he was saving Stanley Lieber for the great American novel, because, you know, at some point it might not be advantageous to have people know that this great novelist had written, you know, Ziggy Pig comics at one time in his life. So he just shortened his name and signed it Stan Lee for a while and never changed.
Jack Kirby created Captain America with Joe Simon in 1940, and then he went off and enlisted in the war and then came home to draw war comics. When he came back and he started drawing war comics, how revealing were those comics? What did
he
find?
He didn't start initially drawing war comics. When he came back, he picked up drawing Boy Commandos, the book he'd left, which I guess was a war comic in a way. And he left off, and he drew. He and Simon started romance comics about that time. They drew a few superhero books, and they did a lot of crime comics. In the post-war era, the comic book industry went through a very dizzying spiral where they really weren't sure what was going to sell. The business had been founded, or a certain part of the business had been founded on superhero books. They were in decline. And Jack was always all about making sales in a very benevolent, strong way. He always wanted to do a comic book that would sell well. War comics came along at some point in there, and they were popular, and mostly in the 50s. But the war had a very strong impact on Jack. In his later years, Jack had nightmares, and he would have two nightmares. He would usually have each of them at least once a week. One of them would be back in World War II. He would have these nightmares. He was back in World War II. And the other nightmare he would have, increasingly after the 50s, was being out of work and being unable to provide for his family. And I suspect that the latter was more life-threatening to him. But he talked about World War II incessantly. If you were with Jack for more than about 15 minutes, you got a World War II story out of him. And it was a life-changing experience for him. And he was very proud of his service, but very overwhelmed by the entire thing. I don't think he ever quite got over it.
Is it something that you think would fall under the category of post-traumatic stress disorder?
I think Jack's whole life was post-traumatic stress disorder in the industry, if not in the war. I would think that there was some of that. I think that it was, you know, Jack was and I mean this in a good sense, he was an armchair fantasist. He was sitting in a little kitchen table for years, at a little dank drawing table, drawing galaxies and drawing other worlds and drawing places he had not been, that he'd been only in his imagination. The war comics were the only time he was drawing someplace that he had actually physically gone. And he had very, very strong opinions about the war. He had, when he was working with Stan Lee on the Marvel comics of the 60s, one of the areas where he and Stan had real arguments, genuine knockdown, drag-out arguments creatively, was about the way the war was being depicted in the book they did, Sergeant Fury. And Jack finally left that book in large part because Stan was not depicting the war the way Jack felt it should be depicted. And, you know, and Jack was fine with, you know, lots of different depictions of superheroes and the Phantom Zone and Asgard. You could do a lot of different things to it, but you couldn't tell Jack how it had been on the beaches of Normandy.
At some point in Kirby's career, he ran right into the buzzsaw of Frederick Wortham, who was the psychiatrist who wrote Seduction of the Innocent, and it was basically McCarthyism of comic books. Can you describe how rabid that scare was and what effect that had on Jack and on comic books then?
Well, one of the biggest effects it had on him is that Jack and Joe Simon had their own comic book company at the time, I think, and their distributor was also distributing EC Comics, which were the leading horror comics, and the comic book scare put the distributor out of business, and it put Jack's company out of the business with it. So that was a very real thing. It also demeaned Jack's business. He hated what it did to the whole field. The remaining publishers got together and came up with this thing called the Comics Code, which Jack felt was a protection racket. It was the leading publishers getting together to squeeze out the small ones and to consolidate their power to control the newsstands. And he didn't like that. He didn't like the fact that Jack was a detester of monopolies, of these power structures that didn't give the little guy a break. As mad as he was at Wortham for demeaning the industry and harming the industry and putting all these guys out of work all these writers and artists out of work, he was probably maddest about the fact that what resulted from it was this power structure where if you wanted to do a comic book, you had to submit it to the Comics Magazine Association of America, which meant essentially letting the publisher of Archie approve your work.
Explain, if you can, when we're talking about a Jack Kirby comic, how much of the writing he actually did, because, you know, I sort of know him as an artist, but he gets some credit for shaping stories. How did that work and how did he work in his partnerships?
Well, Jack was always involved in the story of everything he did to some extent. The few comics where he didn't are some of the most vapid, uninteresting things he ever drew. And nobody really wanted to employ Jack as merely a taker of dictation. He had a great story sense. He wrote a lot of things himself. He co-wrote a lot of them with other people. In the 60s, when they were doing the Marvel books, which most people know him for, they had this method of working where he and Stan Lee would get together on the phone or in person. They would figure out what the story was about. Sometimes Jack would have the idea. Sometimes Stan would have the idea. They would embellish the idea. Jack would go home and he would write. He would draw up the 20 pages or whatever it was, either from based on that conversation, based on a plot outline that Stan would type up after the meeting, or Jack would just make stuff up on his own. It worked all different ways, and then Stan would put in the dialogue after the story was penciled. This led to a certain amount of friction because Jack felt that while he was being credited only as the artist on a lot of this work, he was making up the storylines and figuring out what happened in each panel. He thought that was writing work. Stan felt that since he was writing the balloons, that was the writing work. And, you know, there's a semantic argument there which we could mud wrestle over. But the point is that Jack was contributing more than merely drawing up Stan's ideas. And mm-hmm. Stan has not made any secret of that. He's said it on many, many occasions.
So how would you summarize Jack Kirby's relationship with Stan Lee?
Jack's relationship with Stan Lee was very stormy. It changed over the years. It's no secret that Jack felt he was not compensated properly or credited properly for a lot of the work, and he took some anger at that out at Stan. Stan was not happy with Jack for leaving. He was not happy with some of the things Jack said. They had a contentious relationship at times. There were times they got along. I'm in a very odd position. I worked for both men at different times and, you know, mediated a few little disputes here and there and respect them both tremendously. It's a very complicated relationship that is complicated by the fact that both of these men were working in an industry where they only had so much power and an industry which did not credit either of them properly or give either of them enough compensation. Stan has lived long enough to get the compensation and credit he deserves, and now he is an icon. He goes places, and he's a celebrity, and people throw money at him to be Stan Lee, and I think that's terrific. There was a time when that wasn't the case, and he was being victimized by the way the industry worked as well.
When Fantastic Four number one came out in 1961, how revolutionary was that and why?
Well, it was revolutionary to a lot of us reading comics at that time because, for one thing, it was the first time we got to be on the ground floor of something. If you were reading Superman and Batman, wherever you came into it, they'd existed for, you know, a decade before you. There was all this history you couldn't catch up on. So that was a big deal, something new that was created for us. It had the same impact to a certain extent as a lot of music groups of the 60s did, where part of the appeal was that it wasn't your father's music, it wasn't your parents' music, it was yours. Another thing that was revolutionary about the Fantastic Four, and this is more evident in hindsight than it maybe was at the time, is that they were comics that went to another level. Prior to Fantastic Four, most superhero comics were about one thing. They were about catching the villain. And in 7 pages, Batman would face the villain, and he would fail 3 times to catch the villain. He'd catch him the third or fourth time, and that was the end of the story. And it was only about that. And the Fantastic Four was about the people as much as it was about the hero versus villain mentality. The characters quarreled among themselves. They had relationships among themselves. They had different personality. If you had a scene of the Fantastic Four talking to among themselves, each character had a different attitude, and you could probably identify them just by the balloons if you didn't even know who they were pointing to. That was not the case with a group shot in some of the superhero comics that had preceded that. The characters all talked alike, had the same motives. Most of the comic books prior to Fantastic Four number one, the superhero books, were kind of committee written. There were 9 guys writing Superman. There were 8 guys writing Batman. And that homogenized the work down. Fantastic Four was Stan and Jack. For the first 100 issues, it was just Stan and Jack, who were creatively, if not in sync, they were at least working in the same direction generally. And the work seemed fresh. It seemed like it was targeted to you as a youngster, as opposed to being told by your, you know, the story being told by your great uncle to you, which was the mood of the DC books at the time. And you were in the beginning of a revolution, and it just got better and better. And it was something exciting about going to the newsstand every week and finding the new Marvel, because there'd be something new in it, whereas the DC books at the time didn't have comparable surprises. You weren't watching something being birthed.
With this book being published by Abrams and with the previous book you did on Mad Magazine, why do you think these particular pieces of pop culture are getting more respect lately?
I think because people who grew up in the 60s and 70s are now of an age to be writing the books and the magazines, to be the shapers, the articulators of American pop culture. I think we're all in a position. And this is, I mean, if it's something that Jack kind of forecast. He was well aware that kids who grew up on his comics were one day going to be running movie studios and running networks and film critics and television critics and such. And these people, you know, this is the influence. This is what matters to us. And Jack knew there was going to be a major motion picture of the Hulk and the Silver Surfer and the Fantastic Four. He knew it in his heart. The people he was working for at the time didn't know that and didn't pay him accordingly. But Jack knew that. And he knew what the comic book convention in San Diego was going to become. He forecast that exactly.
And really?
In the early 70s, Jack was the guest of honor at the first comic convention in San Diego. I was there. We had about 500 people at the convention. I think 300 of them were there for his talk. And we thought that was exciting, you know, 300 people at one place. And you go to the comic book convention now, there's 300 people ahead of you in line to buy a hot dog. But Jack knew exactly. He said at that point, and I swear to you, this is almost a verbatim quote. He said in 70, 71, 72, he says, "Someday this convention will be so big, it'll take over all of San Diego, and this will be where Hollywood will come every year to find out what they're going to make next year in movies and to promote what they made last year in movies."
It's exactly what's happened.
Yes. And at the time he said it, we kind of went, "Oh, yeah, sure, Jack, that'll happen." Right.
Well, Mark Evanier, thanks very much. Good luck with your book, and thanks for being on Fresh Air.
Thanks for having me.
Mark Evanier. His new book is called Kirby, King of Comics. And just as an aside, Randy Silverman, wherever you are, if you're listening, I want my comic books back. I sold you my entire complete Marvel comic collection, including all those Jack Kirby classics, when we were in 7th grade. You paid me $75, but if you give them back, I'll pay you double. Terry isn't here today because she's in New York, receiving the Columbia Journalism Award for 2008. It's the highest honor bestowed by Columbia's School of Journalism. So congratulations, Terry. For Terry Gross, I'm David Biancula.